So we've come to the end of Genesis and the end of the Joseph story today, and some of you maybe are happy that we're going to be moving on, but this Genesis ends, and the story of Joseph, it doesn't end just nicely and sweetly and everything just falling into place and everything's hunky-dory. There's some more conflict. There's some more relational reconciliation issues that go on at this in these last few verses, and I think it really shows, the question really is, where does faith connect to our reconciliation with others and then with God? And it also shows us, I think, what does maturity look like in the Christian life? Or if you're not a Christian, what is the Christian life actually all about? Is it just about knowing lots of things, or is it about acting in a certain way? And Joseph really shows us that. And so Amanda's going to come and read our passage for us this morning. So think about the three points we're going to look at. Fear shows the brother's anemic faith. Tears show Joseph's robust faith. And Joseph's last words show God's prevailing faithfulness. So everything's been going along just fine. We left Joseph and the brothers last. They've reconciled. And Joseph's had this interaction with Jacob, his father. But now Jacob's dead. And the brothers are thinking, oh, wait, you know, maybe it was only Dad being alive that kept Joseph from doing harm to us. And so they're, in verse 15, they're saying, it may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for the evil that we did to him. Notice they're thinking, Joseph might not have really reconciled with us. Joseph might still be holding on to this hatred. Maybe he just like covered it over while Dad was alive. And so they're unsure. Right, it might be that this is what's going to happen. Really, they don't have any faith in the reconciliation that was made with them and Joseph. And so they're unsure, they're uncertain of what's really going to be happening. Have you ever had a relationship like that? Where there was sort of some kind of reconciliation, but you weren't really sure, are we good? You're not really quite sure if a true reconciliation has taken place. And so you're a little cautious around that person. You're uncertain of the real status of this relationship. That's what's going on for these brothers right now. They are not sure whether they're in a good place or not. And remember, Joseph's got the power. If he wants to snuff them out, he could. So they're unsure. And, you know, it also raises the question of, are we sure of our place with God? Or are we at a place, or are we in a relationship or a connection with God such that there's a little bit of uncertainty, just like the brothers have here? We're not quite sure how God's going to respond to us. If you come to God and ask for forgiveness, is God going to say, oh, you want forgiveness, do you? Well, we will wait and see what kind of life you live, and then maybe we'll grant forgiveness. You know, actually, if you take all the religions of the world and you line them up, most all of them have an aspect of uncertainty in them. In all the Eastern religions, like Buddhism and Hinduism, there's this karma and reincarnation cycle. You don't know whether you're going up or down in that cycle, except based on your good deeds or bad deeds. And so you don't know for sure what's going to happen, whether you're making progress towards the goal or not. In Islam, you don't know for sure that you have salvation with Allah, because at the end of your life, it says, I think when you hit puberty, a book is opened and all your good deeds and bad deeds are written in that book. And Allah is merciful, but your good deeds and bad deeds need to outweigh your bad deeds in order to achieve salvation. And almost every religious system there is has some aspect of uncertainty. Some uncertainty, a little bit like these brothers are having. Orthodox Christianity doesn't have that uncertainty, but we'll see how that gets worked out later on. So what did the brothers do? The brothers were uncertain about their relationship with Joseph, so what did they do? They sent a message to Joseph saying, your father gave us this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. Really? Think back to last week. Joseph and Jacob have a very close, intimate time. Jacob adopts two of Joseph's sons as his very own. Joseph and Jacob were very tight. If Jacob was worried that Joseph was going to bring about some bad stuff to the brothers after he died, he would have said it to Joseph. And I think actually Jacob saw Joseph's heart, saw his true forgiveness of them, and Jacob wasn't worried. So I think the brothers are making this up. The brothers are lying. But think about what they're doing. Instead of actually coming to Joseph and saying, you know, Joseph, we did despicable things to you. And we've done this reconciliation thing. Are we good, Joseph? I mean, they could have done that, but that would have required vulnerability. So instead, what they do is they do a kind of an end around to try to force reconciliation between, or no, not reconciliation, but they try to force a lack of conflict or a lack of harm to them by invoking their father's name dishonestly, right? They're not actually seeking real reconciliation. They're actually just trying to make sure they don't get hurt. It's almost like they're now in a cold war, right? There's no external hostilities going on, but there's not tight, close, trusting relationship going on. And so it's really, I think, it's the brothers' lack of faith that in Joseph and in this reconciliation that they've sought that is bringing this about. They're fearful, they're uncertain. I think we only get full peace when we have full reconciliation. And full reconciliation requires faith. So that's where the brothers are at. And so in a sense, the brothers, they have a faith in God, but it's not very mature at all. It's just on the surface. Right? They're not really resting and standing on who God is and how God has been at work in them and Joseph's life. And so it's kind of a surfacey, immature faith, you might say. But let's look at Joseph. Joseph's tears show his robust faith. What's Joseph's immediate response to the brothers? He weeps. They're trying to kind of manipulate a detente for themselves, apart from reconciliation, causes him to cry, causes him to grieve, because he has moved towards them in reconciliation. He has forgiven them. And he's made things right on his end with them, but they haven't believed him. And so it causes him to be grieved over it. And so the tears are the first sign, or kind of the emotional sign of Joseph's true forgiveness of them. But look at verse 19. We get kind of an intellectual sign of his forgiveness of them. He says, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God?" Joseph has a belief in God as judge, but God alone is judge. And so even if Joseph's faith tells him that even if he wanted to get back at these brothers, it's not his place to do it. Because he doesn't have the knowledge that God has to bring about judgment. He doesn't have the goodness of character to actually bring about an appropriate judgment. And so he's saying, look, even if I didn't forgive you, I couldn't judge you, because my faith in God says that God alone is judge. And, you know, that's not a very popular view today, that God is judge. And yet, you know, I think it's actually solves a lot of the problems in this world, because look at how the brothers describe in verse 15. Joseph will hate us and pay us back for the evil we did to him. And verse 17, because they did evil to you. And verse 20, you meant evil against me. Does evil exist? What's required for evil to exist? I think first God has to exist for evil to exist, because otherwise we don't have any category for any standard to actually say anything is good or bad. Right? We need some standard to define evil. And so the brothers here are saying evil does exist. We did evil things to you. And so the only way we're going to actually heal evil is by God's judgment. You know, there's a very interesting quote by a guy named Miroslav Volf that, who is a theologian, but who is Croatian. And back during the Croatian conflict and the genocide that was occurring there, he was reflecting theologically about how do you bring about peace in a situation like this where people are being murdered, genocide is occurring right next door to you. And he says here, my thesis that the practice of nonviolence requires a belief in divine vengeance will be unpopular to many, especially in the West. My thesis is this, we should not retaliate against violence with violence. Why not? The only means of prohibiting violence by us is to insist that violence is only legitimate when it comes from God. Violence thrives today, secretly nourished by the belief that God refuses to take the sword. It takes the quiet of a suburb for the birth of the thesis that human nonviolence is a result of the idea of a God who refuses to judge. In a scorched land, soaked in the blood of the innocent, that idea will invariably die, like other pleasant captivities of the liberal mind. In a world of violence, it would not be worthy of God not to wield the sword. If God were not angry at injustice and deception and did not make a final end of violence, God would not be worthy of our worship. What he's saying is that the only way we can actually not promote violence, the only way we can not retaliate to violence with violence is the view that God will one day judge everything and that he alone has the right and the ability to judge those things properly. If I think of God as nice guy, God is full of love, God loves everybody, that view, if I'm in a situation of war or someone has committed violence against me, then without a view that God judges, it encourages me to pick up the sword and to judge myself. Right? When horrible, horrible things happen, something deep inside of us says that everything has to be set right. And if there is no God who sets things right, then I'm encouraged to set things right myself. But Joseph is saying, no, there is a God who will set everything right. And so therefore, I'm not going to set things right with you. I'm actually going to forgive you. But even if I hadn't forgiven you, I'm not going to come against you because that alone is God's place, God's right to do that. And then we also see, we see the emotion of Joseph's forgiveness in his tears. We see the intellectual forgiveness in refusing to judge, but we also see his action, his volition. When he says in verse 21, so do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke to them kindly. Joseph has indeed reconciled on his side with them. And he's showing that with his emotions, with his intellect, but even his actions. He's saying, I've forgiven you so much that I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to take care of your families. I'm going to make sure that you are provided for in the midst of this famine. You know, there's a place in Romans 12 that has a very, very wise phrase that has always helped me. It says, live at peace with everyone else as much as it depends on you. Right? We can't force peace and reconciliation with other people. But so if we pursue reconciliation and it doesn't work out, at least we can say we can pursue peace as much as it depends on me. Joseph is pursuing peace with them as much as it depends on them. And so what we have here in Joseph is we have a mature example of faith. Joseph, what is mature Christian faith? It's not necessarily just knowing a lot of things. It's acting on what you know. Right? Joseph is acting on who he knows about who God is. He's like, I'm not going to judge because only God can judge. And then look at something else he says here in verse 20. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. Joseph has this view that God is indeed at work in the world. And at work so much, so completely, that even though they meant it for evil, that God is able to take their actions and to spin them around so that they actually bring about good. What is it accomplished? It brings about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So, in one hand, God's actions preserves the nation of Israel and preserves even the nation of Egypt. But in chapter 45, when he speaks in similar language, he says, "Now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth to keep alive many survivors." God acted graciously in turning around the brothers' deeds in order to actually to save Israel, in order to save his own people. And so, so Joseph has a strong belief that God is indeed at work in the world, and so he doesn't even assign the evil to the brothers that they've committed because he knows God is at work, actually. And think about, how has God worked here? Is Joseph a minister, a pastor, or a missionary? No, he's a business guy. He's someone who's involved with commerce and business and government. And God, in his acting in the world, chose Joseph to bring about this salvation of his purposes. It's a great kind of alluding to kind of the Protestant view of callings, that God calls all of his people to serve him in the places in which he's put them. That it's not only pastors and missionaries that are serving God, but Joseph here is a huge example of someone with practical business organizational skills that God chooses and that God calls to be used by him in working out his purposes in the world. So Joseph shows us mature faith. He acts on who he knows God to be. He acts on knowing that God is using him in the world and using him in the different places that he's put him. And then we have Joseph's last words. What will be your last words? All right, when there comes a time when you know, most of us probably will know that the end is near when we're of many old and many days, what will you tell your children? What will you tell those around you? This is what will be your last words? Here are Joseph's last words in verse 24. Joseph says to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you will carry up my bones from here." We remember we talked about most all the religions of the world have some aspect of uncertainty built into them. And most of the religions of the world, God or the divine force is kind of stands off and lets you come to him. That God holds all the cards or the divine force holds all the pieces and makes you be vulnerable and uncertain while God is certain and secure. But look what Joseph says. "I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." God swore to Abraham that I will richly bless you and I will give you a great land as your salvation. The God of the Bible bound himself to a promise to Abraham. The God of the Bible didn't stand off and say, "Well, if you do well, I'll give you some good stuff." Before Abraham had even done anything good at all, God comes and says, "I'll commit myself to you that you will receive this blessing of promise that I'm going to give you." And so the God of the Bible is different from all those other religious systems because the God of the Bible doesn't remain secure, but he himself acts and puts himself in a place where he's promising to act amongst his people. And so Christians actually are not in a place of vulnerability, because salvation is not based on our actions or evaluations of our actions, but it's based on God's promise and God's choosing to bind himself to us, to promise, to take an oath to us himself. The end of Hebrews, when it talks about the faith of the different people, it talks of Joseph's faith. It says, "By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones." It's when he says, "God will visit you and bring you up out of this land," that Joseph is saying, you're going to need to be saved out of Egypt, and God is going to come and rescue you out of Egypt in the Exodus. And so that's Joseph's faith of testifying to who God is. So this God who binds himself to us by his oath and his faith, God is vulnerable in the Old Testament, but he's even more vulnerable in the New Testament, right? God is vulnerable towards us to woo us in salvation and in giving his son, in Jesus coming to earth and living and dwelling amongst us, in dying on the cross and rising again. And it's in the Lord's Supper that we see Jesus reminding us of this oath, that God is swearing to bless us, that God is swearing and putting himself under the bind in order to draw us into salvation to himself.